All right, everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, administrator, and I'm joined on the phone by Greg Palast. He is one of America's last investigative reporters, which is, of course, why he writes for the British papers, The Observer and The Guardian, and does reports for BBC Newsnight. There's a new expanded edition of his book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Truth About Corporate Cons, Globalization, and the High Finance Fraudsters, out now. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Palast.
Hey, Phil, I'm really glad to be with you.
All right, well, before we go dive into the substance of your book, I'd like to get your take on a couple of recent news items here. First of all, you know things are bad when they're censoring Ted Koppel, am I right?
Yeah, I mean, what did it censor, man? You know, I mean, I would censor the wig. I mean, that's got to go. But, you know, the rest is pretty benign, you know. We're not supposed to talk about the Jessica Lynch capturing Saddam Hussein. That we're allowed to do, but you know, we're ashamed of the dead. We're taking pornographic pictures of Iraqi soldiers, but you know, names of the dead. That's forbidden.
Yeah, I guess what was it? A third of the United States had a Nightline blacked out last night, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, listen, dangerous stuff. You know, I mean, what they said was, naming the dead was it some type of anti-war political statement. You know, during World War II, when you named the dead, they were honored because they were fighting Nazis who were really out to kill us. And it was, you know, and no one said, gee, don't name the dead because, you know, that's a political statement against the war. You know what? Americans aren't very good at imperialism. We don't really like it. And they know that, so that's why they don't want that info.
Yeah, you know, Ted Koppel made a little statement at the end where he said, you know, if you're pro-war, then you're going to use this to spin it your way and say that, well, we can't just have all these people die in vain. We have to accomplish their mission. And if you're anti-war, then you can say, well, look at all these lives that George Bush has wasted. And you can spin it either way, however you like, but they just don't want us reminded of the fact that there's actual human cost to this. A war is not a video game.
Yeah, and the other thing that we're leaving out, of course, is we're not having any programs naming the Iraqis. You know, and
oh, of course not.
You know, that's the, you know, don't forget, 3 million people, 3 million Vietnamese died during the war in Vietnam. 3 million. You know, it's just unimaginable. It was a Holocaust. And you know what? Americans don't want to be reminded of that either, because we ain't killers, and we don't like being in that position. We were attacked, and you know, maybe George should like go after the guys who did it. But you know, of course, that involves going after the guys who also fund his oil companies.
Oh no! Well.
Oh no! He said that. Oh, looks like I won't be on CBS Evening News tonight.
Oh no! I guess not.
Yeah.
Oh man! Well, so and this brings up the next question, which is, here we are in America. We have the First Amendment, and yet the Brits have all the good journalism.
Got John Pilger and the really tremendous, you know, Robert Fisk and Anthony Barnett. I mean, you know, we have in Britain no written First Amendment. Okay, so, you know, I mean, they can borrow ours because we're not using it, right? So the stories I do, the investigative reports, I guess, I think investigative reporting is illegal under Patriot Act 4 or something. You know, I can't tell you why, except that the truth ain't out there.
Yes.
So that's why I'm in a way reduced to writing books. Like, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, the reason I had to do the expanded election edition, well, part of it is because if this is the last election, it'll become a collector's item. And the other is that the reports I have there are played on the nightly news, BBC television, worldwide, except the United States of America. I mean, when we talk about, it's a joke, but it's not a joke about George and his buddies. You know, at the September 11th committee, you couldn't mention, you know, there were two words that could not leave the lips of the commissioners, our questioners, Saudi Arabia. And, you know, our president is so concerned about the victims of September 11th, you know, the families of the victims have sued Saudi Arabia for giving money to the guys that killed us, right?
Right.
And the president has actually put a lawyer on the case in the White House. But the lawyer is the guy representing the Saudis against the families of the victims. And that's James Baker III. And he's actually down off of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, use of an Air Force jet. And, you know, the guy represents the Saudi government. The guy represents ExxonMobil, special counsel to Carlyle Group. And, not incidentally, the guy who, as James Baker himself said to a bunch of Russians, I'm the guy that fixed the election for George Bush in Florida. He was the guy that was the chief lawyer for George Bush and Bush v. Gore.
And you write in your book that he's also the same guy who told the ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie, to go ahead and give Saddam Hussein permission to invade Kuwait in 1990.
That's right. The phrase from April Glaspie, our ambassador, in July, I think it was 25th, of 1990, go right ahead, when Saddam asked her, can I invade Kuwait? And she said, Secretary Baker, Mr. Jimbo himself, told me to tell you that the United States has no interest in Kuwait. And basically that means, you know, hey, go ahead and let him have it. Now, see, the thing is, Saddam made a little mistake. He's supposed to just grab pieces of the oil fields because Kuwait was stealing his oil. But when he saw no resistance, he kind of rolled on into Kuwait City and did this 19th province, et cetera. He was just a little renegade, you know, on the boys. But let's not forget that Saddam Hussein, like Osama bin Laden, came out of the Bush family Frankenstein factory. And that's, you know, but, you know, Jimbo was the guy who said, go and invade. And now he's the guy, and then, by the way, he was also the guy who said, you'd have to be dumber than a brick to roll all the way to, you know, when we won Gulf War I, remember, a lot of people were saying, including Democrats, why don't we go all the way to Baghdad? And Jim Baker and Colin Powell said, you have to be dumb as a box of rocks to occupy, if you invade Baghdad, you have to occupy Iraq, and you have to be completely insane to do that. Well, here they are, circus is in town, and we're bringing home our boys in boxes.
Wow, so this is a whole can of worms here, and I'm really not sure I understand completely. Perhaps you can kind of describe what exactly is going on with the relationship between the Bushes, the Saudis, the Exxon, and James Baker, and
well, here's what's happening.
Between big oil companies and big government, or what?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the oil Democrats, there's the oil Republicans. In fact, I just spoke to lobbyists for the industry. Jim Baker's the big fundraiser for the Republicans, and his partner Ed Morris of Amron has the big fundraiser for the Democrats. So, so you got the oilocrats win the election either way. However, I'm not one of these cynical guys. There's absolutely no difference. You know, I want to be a little bit cautious there, because I will say that, you know, in my investigations, I've found out that President Clinton, not necessarily one of my favorites, I got to tell you, but he did in the year 2000 send two delegations to Saudi Arabia to say, listen, would you stop giving money to the guys that are killing us? Because, you know, Osama had already bombed the embassies. And he tried to rocket Osama in Afghanistan. And Robert Oakley, now this is the guy that advised the Bush administration in their transition from Clinton, right? Oakley said, we have our Bush team has no big problem with the Clinton foreign policy except for Bill Clinton's fixation with eliminating Osama bin Laden.
I wish
that Mr. Bush...
swatting at flies, it was that he didn't want anybody swatting at anything.
Yeah, he was swatting at flies. I think he was, eating flies, but they don't like to say that without a long tongue. You know? Have you ever noticed that when he lies, our president, I shouldn't say lie, when he repeats the lies that are told to him. Remember, he's no longer responsible, right? You read Bob Woodward. It wasn't the president's fault. They gave him faulty intelligence. You don't call it him. Anyway, he always takes his tongue out between his teeth. Have you ever noticed that little habit he has? You know, he talks about no child behind him. Yeah, he keeps his eyebrows knitted low because I told him to stop looking like a deer caught in the headlights. And then he sticks his tongue out between his lips. You can't watch a speech anymore without that driving you completely nuts. You know, he says, we are going to Iraq to bring them democracy. Lick, lick. And I just had an interview with Garner, the first Pasha we put into power in Iraq, if you remember. This is before Jerry Bremer. And I interviewed him for BBC News, Jay Garner. And, one of the reasons he was pushed out, he was fired the day he arrived in Baghdad, because when he got off the plane, he announced, he took Bush seriously when Bush said we're going to, you know, bring these poor Iraqis democracy. And he said, well, we'll have elections within 90 days.
You're fired.
And he said he got a call from Rumsfeld that night. Don't unpack. You're out. And the thing is, and the reason is that, well, first of all, there's no sense having elections, free elections in Baghdad before you have them in Florida, right? But what you do need, you know, the other problem was, I uncovered, and you'll find this also in the new version of Best Democracy Money Can Buy, is that I have a 101-page document from inside the U.S. State Department, which was begun, like, days after the inauguration, literally before they returned the rented tuxes from the inaugural ball, that they already were working on what they call the long-term options for disposition of the oil of Iraq.
And what did they decide in there?
And what they decide is that they're going to, as they say, privatize, that is, sell off all the assets, including, and it says especially, the oil industry. And actually, it's been a little tussle at the top, I've been finding out, between the neocons and big oil, because big oil doesn't want absolutely everything stolen. They need one central oil buying national oil company so that they can maintain the OPEC quotas. Because that's why, if you're wondering why Jim Baker has an office in the White House, and by the way, if you're wondering how he could do that with all those, there's a conflict of interest Christmas tree, this guy, right? I mean, have you ever heard, of an oil, an oil company lobbyist is literally has an office right in the White House. I mean, so I have to say, in fact, I understand that Bush offered him, said he could use the Oval Office desk while Bush played on the carpet, made that up. But the truth is that he was not appointed. I called the White House and said, oh, he's not appointed by the president. He's appointed by the Governing Council of Iraq. In other words, the puppet government we install it. We install a puppet government at gunpoint, and they appoint his lawyer as their lawyer. And so we don't have to, no congressional hearings, no discussion of conflicts. And one of the things that he's there to do, James Baker, was the neocon, little Mr. Wolfowitz, the wolf, stepped out of line, right? And, they don't mind the neocons telling us bald-faced lies under oath in Congress. But they made a mistake. They upset the oil companies because they weren't going to reestablish the National Oil Company of Iraq, which Saddam had broken up. So now they're going to reestablish the oil company. So big oil wants that, and the Saudis want that oil company reestablished to maintain the OPEC quota. Because if Iraq starts producing more than its 4 million barrel a day quota, then OPEC is kaput. Because, it just flood the world with oil, and the Saudis are, up their tent without a paddle. And so, when it comes down to, forget the battles over Fallujah, and forget the battles over sheikhs and Shiites and the rest. The real battle in Iraq is between the neocons and the oligarchs over the shape of the National Oil Company of Iraq. And whether it will stick to OPEC quotas. I do have to say, when I asked an oil company executive, so we can win this battle, he says, he says it's like Godzilla versus Girl Scouts, because the final decision is made by, the commander-in-chief, that is Dick Cheney. He says, you can put it in those terms. He said, Dick Cheney runs all of the energy policy in the United States, and he comes from our side, big oil.
Well, this was the conflict that got Jay Garner fired in the first place, right? I remember seeing a front line about how the State Department and the CIA had come up with this whole plan that Jay Garner was supposed to do, and then how Cheney, in that case, had taken the side of the neocons and forced Garner out and put in Jerry Bremer, and
that's right.
Was going to let the neocons put their guy Chalabi in place and all that kind of thing. So is this continuation of that same conflict?
Yeah, and what's happened is that Cheney, though, now is spanking the neocons because they said those words that may not pass anyone's lips in this White House, which is that we're going to bust OPEC and bust the Saudis. So the neocons are getting too big for their Humvees.
Right.
You know, that was one of the problems. See, I mean, this is, and I'm working on this now for Rolling Stone, as a matter of fact. But you know, the point of the book is to let you know what you're not. You know, what is now kind of Sommies.information. I mean, but it's all over the world press. I mean, I actually did an interview with Jay Garner for BBC, I mean, which you couldn't see in the United States of America. And frankly, he's kind of reluctant to speak on camera in the United States of America because he gets savage. I mean, they ran stories about this guy planted by the White House. The White House did a hit on their own guy because they didn't want anyone talking democracy. They said he was incompetent, he was hapless, he was unlikable, blah, blah, blah. I mean, and they replaced him with a guy. Garner had years of experience in Iraq and was actually well-liked by the Iraqi people, well-known to the Iraqi people, by the way. Whereas Bremer, his total experience is that he worked for 3 decades for Henry Kissinger. That's his experience.
Well, that's funny, because I thought the neocons hated Henry Kissinger, and he was...
They do... But Bremer agreed to carry the plan. Now we have, you know, but on the other hand, the point of Kissinger, too, is to babysit, because Kissinger is another guy on the oil side of things. In fact, by the, you know, I mean, let's not forget that Kissinger was not exactly in love with the idea of invading Iraq, because he thought this might get out of control. Not when he means out of control, he doesn't mean, you know, that our kids get killed. You know, hell, people, you know, Kissinger's always, you know, well, you know, more people die in road accidents. You know, that's his lovely line about you know, Americans dying in battle. But he, you know, out of line means crossing the oil companies, who are his clients as well.
Right, and you know, I think this is something we talked about last time you were on the show, was that the neocons, they're so pro-Israel and so anti-Wahhabi, whatever it is, that really they're bent on invading Saudi Arabia if they thought they could get away with it.
And so now they're being spanked. You don't ever talk about invading Saudi Arabia, you know, messing with their OPEC quotas. That ain't the facts of oil life in the United States of America. That's why Jim Baker has an office there. So that, Wolfowitz also built up his stock, just so you know, by going before Congress and saying that the war would pay for it, that the Iraqis would pay for their own invasion. That they'd pump $50 to $100 billion in oil. Over 5 years. $50 to $100 billion in oil over 5 years. Well, of course, the oil guys, you know, are rolling their eyes while he's saying this. I mean, this, you know, we'll find that oil with the weapons of mass destruction. It was, you have to understand, this is perjury before Congress, because he actually was given reports. He was given reports of high, medium, low output. And not one of them, the highest fantasy output, was nowhere close to that. And the reason is that if you actually try to pump $100 billion worth of oil out of the ground, who are you going to sell it to? You collapse the price of oil, you'd never make it. So, you know, so the oil guys are rolling their eyes, but he was telling the soothing lie to get the point across. But now that the neocons are saying, oh, well, look what we did, you know, we got the war, we got a war on, you know, their warnography got everyone hot to invade. And, you know, that's, but now their usefulness is over, and now the adults move in and say, you know, forget the, you know, see, no one cares. At the upper level, the Israeli-Palestinian thing is like, that's off the map. You know, those people over there, they're in NOPEC, you know, not oil, not petroleum exporting countries, you know.
Right.
They don't care. That's for you know, the front page and the pundit. Yeah, you know, it's just, you know. So what you're talking is you know, the big money, the big action, follow the money, and when you follow the money, you got to follow the oil. But, the, you know, one of the other things that I want to bring up in the book is, the reason why it's called the Special Elections Edition, too, is that, you know, the book keeps getting bigger, is we are now moving, you know, we are now, our president has signed something called the Helping Americans Vote Act.
Wait, hang on. Let's get to the whole electronic voting scam thing.
Oh, yeah.
But on the Iraq thing, I wonder, I mean, I know that, you know, like Karen Katowski says, that the goal was to go in there and build 4 bases and have 4 bases.
Yeah.
And I kind
of
wonder.
That was one of the goals, yeah.
With all this, the torture story that CBS sat on for a month and then finally put on TV after it was going to get out anyway, and the disaster of Fallujah and Najaf with solder and all this mess, I wonder, is it really realistic from James Baker's perspective to think that we can really hold on to the oil? I mean, isn't that just too bad a PR at this point? Aren't we just
going
to have to get out?
Well, that's why the oil companies, that's the other reason, by the way, that the oil companies are pushing to tape back together the National Oil Company of Iraq. See, Saddam had broken it up because he didn't want a big oil company that could basically challenge him, see? So he broke it up into three parts. They want to put it back together so we'll hold to the OPEC quotas. And the advantage is that we can say, hey, we didn't take their oil, they got a national oil company. But then what happens is that the actual production that is run through something called PSAs, Profit Sharing Agreements, which are very, as one oil executive said to me, will be very, very sweet. And I would just like to have the deal with Aramco, which is, the Saudi Arabian oil is all moved through Aramco, which is the Arabian American Oil Company. And technically, it's Saudi-owned, but, their partners are the Arabian American Oil Company, obviously benefits the American majors. In fact, the Wall Street Journal yesterday, if you caught it, had the very good news. See, you keep saying things are going badly, but you got to remember, yesterday the Wall Street Journal announced that both Exxon and Shell Oil earned record profits.
Oh, then everything's going great.
Everything's fine. I don't see what the problem is. I mean, it's fine. But again, yeah, you're right. They can't. That's why now the oil company plan is almost a lock-in because it allows the fantasy that we're going to let Iraqis have their oil. But, that's not in the game plan. They're not going to have their... So the reason we don't have elections is that there's no government, and I don't care whether it's that bank, whether Chalabi or Shiite or Shoshone, they're not going to... as Jay Garner said, they're not going to give us their oil on the terms we want. So therefore, they're locking in the deals now. In fact, you should read this stuff from Paul Bremer. He's given them a flat tax code. He's given them, it's a free fire, free trade zone now. No tariffs. The only major nation on the planet without tariffs. The whole right-wing free market fruitcake agenda. And he begins each of his orders with I, Paul Bremer III. Under my authority, under the usages of war. You like that phrase, usages of war? I mean, I always thought, the tragedy of war, the sad, the horror of war, but there's usages of war, and these guys have figured out. That's how it's working. So,
I want to pick a fight with you about this whole right-wing free market thing. There are a few times throughout your book, and I just finished it this morning, where you go ahead and put the ironic quotes around free trade. But a lot of times you don't. And a lot of times you seem to completely mix the idea of free trade capitalism with as though it's perfectly the same thing as this Cheney-style mercantilism, which, to my mind, much more resembles the British East India Company than anything that Adam Smith would approve of.
Right. Well, let's remember, Adam Smith was a radical lefty. I don't know how the right wing suddenly picked him up as their guy. He was against privilege, power, and special inside deals. When we talk about it, the reason I say why I go after the free trade, the so-called free trade game, is that it's anything but free.
Right.
They're not really talking about free anything. Okay, it's never balanced trade. That's why I quote a lot. If you'll see in my book, I have a section called Globalization and Discontents, right? Burn the olive tree, sell the Lexus. It's a response to Thomas Friedman. Joe Stiglitz, who was chief economist of the World Bank, said, look, the type of free trade that America and Europe is talking about in dealing with the rest of the world is free trade like the Opium Wars was free trade. We put a gun to their head and say, you buy our computers, you pay us for to copy Madonna's songs for whatever reason you might want them. You pay for it, but we won't let your oranges in. We won't let your cotton in, And so it's a one-way deal, and the free trade is never free because there's no gain in that. I mean, someone's always going to put in the fix. It's too easy to do. And I actually have documents from inside the world, the World Trade Organization, in which you can see the hands of the lobbyists. There's something called the Lotus Committee that I describe in there, which is, Prudential, Lloyd's of London, that whole operation. And and they are basically writing out the terms of this so-called free trade, which is anything but free trade. I mean, they're talking about, you know, go ahead, see, if Argentina wants to sell South Africa cheap drugs, suddenly you will find that free trade ain't so free. They're going to stop it, and they have stopped it.
Right. Hey, if it's okay, can we do, like, the whole four steps of the IMF?
Well, one of the problems is I have to go, I'm expected at Barbara's Bookstore, for those of you in Chicago, at 4 o'clock today, Barbara's Bookstore at Circle Campus, Roosevelt and Halsted. I'll be in New York tomorrow, Sunday, Cooper Union, 4 p.m., and then on to Washington, Los Angeles, and Washington and Los Angeles and San Diego.
Okay, so we better wrap this up pretty quick then, huh?
So, unfortunately, we gotta be wrapping, but...
Okay, well...
You know, I'm...
Oh, go
yep.
Go
yeah, no, I'm just saying, until Patriot Act 3, you're still allowed to read the book.
Yeah. Yeah, well, maybe the Patriot Act 2, when the rest of it is finally passed, piece by piece. But anyway, yeah, I just wanted to, on the whole free trade thing, I just wanted to point out there's a big difference between Milton Friedman and Murray Rothbard, and...
Well, let's not forget. I mean, I'm here in Chicago right now speaking to you, and I was a student of Milton Friedman. But, you know, I understand very well what free trade ought to be. But it ain't never going to be that way because there's too much money to be made in fixing the rules. And that's exactly what Adam Smith talked about. The reason there's a World Trade Organization is not to give us free trade. It's to control it. And if you control it, it ain't free anymore. And that's what's happening.
Okay, who am I going to vote for this year? And will I even get to choose, or...?
Who are you going to vote for? Well, you may have already voted, Phil. They just haven't told you. We've moved to computers, haven't you heard? So Debo may have already made your choice, and I'm sure you'll be happy with what they picked out for you. Yeah, what's happened is that our president did sign this law, Helping Americans Vote Act, and I'm a bit concerned when our president tells us he's going to help us vote. But one of the things in there, of course, is $4 billion to help promote, mainly to promote computerization of the vote. And here's the real danger. My good friend Bev Harris has done a tremendous job in getting the inside documents and showing how you can just hack the vote. You know, I mean, it's there, it can be done. I just talked to David Dill at Stanford University Computer Sciences, you know, and he was just like, he's gasping at what he's seeing. You know, it's like he says, the end of democracy.
University said the same thing.
Yeah, and, you know, but here's the big danger, and Johns Hopkins showed how it works. It's the simple stuff. Forget turning a Democratic vote to Republican. It's polls open late. Polls screw up. Votes are lost. You know, and they did a test run on this thing. Catherine Harris ordered the imposition of touchscreen voting machines in Florida. This was going to be her big fix to the steal from last time. Okay? And they, in Broward County, in the white precincts of the county, it looks like things went smoothly. I mean, we don't know because can't see for those black boxes, but it looked like things went smoothly. In the black precincts, they couldn't find the passwords, power outages, machines were locked up, people were told, come back, you know, in 5 hours. So thousands and thousands of black votes were lost in the computerization. Thousands and thousands of black votes were lost. In other words, the computers worked perfectly. And that's what's going to happen. Here's the ugly little fact that you'll find in the book from the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, part of their report that was buried. 180,000 votes were never counted in Florida. According to the Civil Rights Commission, they began looking at my evidence and they took it much further.
180,000.
1,000 votes were just tossed in the dumpster. They called them spoiled. Spoiled votes! Okay? I mean, things like people wrote the name Al Gore. And they said, oh, we can't discern the intent of the voter. 180,000 votes. According to the investigators and statisticians for both the Civil Rights Commission and Harvard University Law School, which was brought in, 54% of the votes cast were apparently cast by black voters. 54%. You know, and what that means is that if you are a black voter, were 1,000% more likely to have your vote voided than if you're a white voter. And they said they had nothing to do with voter education, sophistication, any of that stuff. like big games, like for example, in Gadsden County, the blackest county in Florida, if you made a mistake on your ballot, sorry, Jack, your ballot was thrown out. Next door in Tallahassee, in Neon County, White County, you made a mistake on your ballot, they gave you a new one. They would check, the ballots were electronically checked in the White Counties. If you made a mistake, you get up to three ballots. Now, and it has nothing to do with the sophistication of the voters, because they fixed the machines in Gadsden, in the next 2002 election, no votes were lost, which is why they want to change those machines again to computers, because that's how it's going to happen. You're going to have the big blackout. And it's not just Florida. The Civil Rights Commission and Harvard's statistician, this guy, Bill Klinkner, said it, Florida is typical that we, you know, 1.9 million votes were voided in the 2000 election nationwide. 1.9 million votes. I mean, this is not an estimation. This is an exact count precinct by precinct.
And this is the system that this corruption in Florida is what they're spreading to the whole rest of the country now.
They're taking the Florida show on the road, man. And that's why I'm also writing the new edition now, because last time I broke the story of how they stole the election, you know, within weeks of the election, but it was afterwards. I figure we better talk about stealing the election beforehand to kind of put out the burglar alarms.
Right.
You know, that's the point.
I sure am privileged to have you on the Weekend Interview Show. I want to ask you one last thing before you go.
Okay.
I've been trying to find out the answer to this question. I knew it was something, but I just didn't know what it was.
Okay.
Until I read your book, I guess I got to this part yesterday or the day before, and I went, wow, there it is. Why was it that the Republicans impeached Bill Clinton for the blowjob scandal and not for all the Chinese money and technology transfers and so forth? And you finally answered my question.
Bless you, Phil, for finding it. I thought that was an important story. We ran it in Britain in the most important Sunday paper in Britain, and what it was a deal was cut. And I was told this by the Democratic leadership. I think it was cut. We don't go after Bill Clinton's Chinese money, which is really an impeachable offense. Taking $1 million from the Chinese is like not to be done. It's a felony and a fairly reasonable reason to lose office. So why didn't they go after what was the real thing instead of the zipper stuff? And the answer was the Democrats said, you back off Bill's Chinaman, and we will back off the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, Koch brothers. These are the guys that put up $25 million in funny money, illegal money, into key Republican districts which turned the congressional majority over to Newt Gingrich. And that's so that the Clintons had their billionaires, the Riottis, Republicans had their billionaires, Koch brothers, and they said, you know, it was another case of let's make a deal. And, you know, no one's actually, you know, when I broke the story, got the inside stuff taped, by the way, no one's ever denied it, that they just sit and grin. So it explains what seems inexplicable that no one seems to ask. They really had the stuff on Clinton to impeach him. It had nothing to do with some chickie under the desk.
Yeah, I mean, hell, I had enough to impeach him for the China connection.
Yeah.
And I was just sitting at home clipping crap out of the New York Times over 10 months late, you know?
You don't need much.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was sitting there. It was sitting there. So, and in fact, see, the reason I got that information, just so you know, if you're wondering why they dropped that on me, some of these Democratic insiders, they were hopping mad. They said that Monica was kind of a breaking the deal. But on the other hand, it was still too sweet a deal to kick over, because, you know, again, then Clinton would have been in real trouble. So they took the hit on Monica,
yep.
Which, not surprisingly, it was no surprise at all that Clinton survived that.
Well, sure, they knew, and that was the whole deal. And, you know, if you look at the year in 1998, they knew by summer that there was no way he could ever be impeached for that. But I think it was May of 98 that Jeff Gerth and the New York Times started writing about the missile technology transfers, and they had the Cox Committee meeting. And it was after that Clinton went and perjured himself before the grand jury as though he wanted, go ahead and impeach me for the Lewinsky thing, because I know I'll never be removed for it. But
well, it's the old circus
thing back up again.
You know, I did not have sex with that woman. Mission accomplished. You know, they learn how to pull out a new circus act when the people need to be distracted. You know, that is, and so that's the idea. If So anyway, so you could, let's get together again and go over the rest of the nasty stuff. Let's not agree too much, Phil. But let's at least get some of this info out. I really appreciate the fact that that's one thing you're allowing me to do. Because I'm on BBC Nightly News, the big national nightly news program on this planet. But I can't get into my own United States of America. I'm an American guy. I want my kids to be American, and you're giving me that kind of break. You're opening that crack in the electronic Berlin Wall. I hope that your listeners appreciate what is happening here right now, because it could go away in a very bad puff of smoke.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. Greg Palast.
Okay, thanks.
For The Observer, The Guardian, BBC News Night TV, and his book is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy.